The three-member panel also contained another conservative judge, so Sentell could do whatever he wanted. On August the 5th, Sentell fired Robert Fisk and replaced him with Kenneth Starr, who had been a Court of Appeals judge and Solicitor General in the Bush administration. Unlike Fisk, Starr had no prosecutorial experience, but he had something far more important. He was much more conservative and much more partisan than Fisk. In a terse statement, Judge Sentell said he was replacing Fisk with Starr to guarantee the, quote, appearance of independence, a test Fisk could not meet because he was, quote, affiliated with the incumbent administration. It was an absurd argument. Fisk was a Republican whose only affiliation with my administration was that Janet Reno had appointed him to a job he did not seek. Had the Special Division reappointed him, there would have been no more affiliation. In Fisk's place, Judge Sentell's panel appointed someone with not an apparent, but a real and blatant conflict of interest. Starr had been an outspoken proponent of the Paula Jones lawsuit, appearing on TV and even offering to write a friend of the court brief on her behalf. Five former presidents of the American Bar Association criticized the Starr appointment because of its apparent political bias. So did the New York Times, after it emerged that Judge Sentell had had lunch with Fisk's biggest critic, Senator Locke Faircloth, and Jesse Helms, just a couple of weeks before the Fisk-Starr switch. The three said they were just discussing prostate problems. Of course, Starr had no intention of stepping aside. His bias against me was the very reason he was chosen in the first place and why he took the job. We now had a bizarre definition of an independent counsel. He had to be independent of me, but it was fine to be closely tied to my political enemies and legal adversaries. Near the end of September, Newt Gingrich gathered more than 300 Republican incumbents and candidates for a rally on the Capitol steps to sign a contract with America. The details of the contract had been percolating for some time. Newt had put them together to show that the Republicans were more than naysayers. They had a positive agenda. The contract was something new to American politics. Traditionally, midterm elections had been fought seat by seat. National conditions and a president's level of popularity could be a boost or a drag, but the conventional wisdom held that the local factors were more important. Gingrich was convinced that the conventional wisdom was wrong. He boldly asked the American people to give the Republicans a majority, saying, "If we break this contract, throw us out. We mean it." The contract called for a balanced budget amendment and the line item veto, which enables the president to delete specific items in appropriations bills without having to veto the entire piece of legislation. For stiffer penalties for criminals and repeal of the prevention programs in my crime bill. For welfare reform with a 2-year limit on able-bodied recipients. For a $500 child tax credit, another $500 for the care of a parent and grandparent, and tougher child support enforcement. For repeal of the taxes on upper-income Social Security recipients that were part of the 1993 budget. For a 50% cut in the capital gains tax. For an end to unfunded federal mandates on state and local government. For a large increase in defense spending. For tort reform to limit punitive damages. For term limits for senators and representatives. For a requirement that Congress has to follow all laws it has imposed on other employers. For a reduction in congressional staffs by a third. And a requirement that 60% of each House of Congress approve any future tax increases. I agreed with many of the particulars of the contract. I was already pushing welfare reform and tougher child support enforcement, and had long supported the line item veto and ending unfunded mandates. I liked the family tax credit. Though several of the specifics were appealing, the contract was, at its core, a simplistic and hypocritical document. The Republicans, with the support of a few Democrats in Congress, had quadrupled the national debt in the 12 years before I became president by cutting taxes and increasing spending. Now that Democrats were reducing the deficit, they wanted the Constitution to require a balanced budget, even as they recommended large tax cuts and big increases in defense spending, without saying what other spending they would cut to pay for them. Just as they had done in the 1980s and would do again in the 2000s, the Republicans were trying to abolish arithmetic. As Yogi Berra said, it was deja vu all over again, but in a nice new package. On November 8th, we got the living daylights beat out of us, losing 8 Senate seats and 54 House seats, the largest defeat for our party since 1946, when the Democrats were routed after President Truman tried to get health insurance for all Americans. The Republicans were rewarded for 2 years of constant attacks on me and for their solidarity on the contract. The Democrats were punished for too much good government and too little good politics. I had contributed to the demise by allowing my first weeks to be defined by gays in the military, by failing to concentrate on the campaign until it was too late, by trying to do too much too fast, in a news climate in which my victories were minimized, my losses were magnified, and the overall impression was created that I was just another pro-tax, big government liberal, not the new Democrat who had won the presidency. Moreover, the public mood was still anxious. People didn't feel their lives were improving, and they were sick of all the fighting in Washington. Apparently, they thought divided government would force us to work together. I was profoundly distressed by the election, far more than I ever let on in public. Gingrich had proved to be a better politician than I was. He understood that he could nationalize a midterm election with the contract, with incessant attacks on the Democrats, and with the argument that all the conflicts and bitter partisanship in Washington the Republicans had generated must be the Democrats' fault, since we control both Congress and the White House. Because I had been preoccupied with the work of the presidency, I hadn't organized, financed, and forced the Democrats to adopt an effective national countermessage. The nationalization of midterm elections was Newt Gingrich's major contribution to modern electioneering. From 1994 on, if one party did it and the other didn't, the side without a national message would sustain unnecessary losses. It happened again in 1998 and in 2002. On the day after the election, I tried to make the best of a bad situation, promising to work with the Republicans and asking them to join me in the center of the public debate where the best ideas for the next generation of American progress must come. I suggested that we work together on welfare reform and the line item veto, which I supported. For the time being, there was nothing more I could do. Within a week of the election, I was hard at work again, as were the Republicans. Newt Gingrich, basking in the afterglow of his big victory, kept up the withering personal attacks that had proved so successful in the campaign. Just before the election, he had taken a page from his pamphlet of smear words, calling me, quote, the enemy of normal Americans. On the day after the election, he called Hillary and me counterculture McGovernicks, his ultimate condemnation. The epithet Gingrich hurled at us was correct in some respects. We had supported McGovern, and we weren't part of the culture he wanted to dominate America. The self-righteous, condemning, absolute, truth-claiming dark side of white Southern conservatism. I was a white Southern Baptist who was proud of my roots and confirmed in my faith. But I knew the dark side all too well. Since I was a boy, I had watched people assert their piety and moral superiority as justifications for claiming an entitlement to political power, and for demonizing those who begged to differ with them, usually over civil rights. I thought America was about building a more perfect union, widening the circle of freedom and opportunity, and strengthening the bonds of community across the lines that divide us. Even though I was intrigued by Gingrich and impressed by his political skills, I didn't think much of his claim that his politics represented America's best values. I had been raised not to look down on anyone and not to blame anyone else for my own problems or shortcomings. That's exactly what the New Right message did. But it had enormous political appeal because it offered both psychological certainty and escape from responsibility. They were always right. We were always wrong. We were responsible for all the problems, even though they had controlled the presidency for all but six of the last 26 years. Now, all of us are vulnerable to arguments that let us off the hook. And in the 1994 election, in an America where hardworking middle-class families felt economic anxiety and were upset by the pervasiveness of crime, drugs, and family dysfunction, there was an audience for the Gingrich message, especially when we didn't offer a competing one. Still, I didn't want to demonize Gingrich and his crowd as they had done to us. He had some interesting ideas, especially in the area of science, technology, and entrepreneurialism, and was a committed internationalist in foreign policy. Also, I had thought for years that the Democratic Party needed to modernize its approach, to focus less on preserving the party's industrial age achievements and more on meeting the challenges of the information age, and to clarify our commitment to middle-class values and concerns. I welcomed the chance to compare our New Democrat ideas on economic and social problems with those embodied in the contract with America. Politics at its best is about the competition of ideas and policy. But Gingrich didn't stop there. The core of his argument was not just that his ideas were better than ours. He said his values were better than ours, because Democrats were weak on family, work, welfare, crime, and defense, and because being crippled by the self-indulgent 60s, we couldn't draw distinctions between right and wrong.